So we are now recording. So the audio recording along with the contents of the chat window and the deck that's being presented tonight will go up on our website later on this evening. And I will mute all. And as I mentioned, everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please do so if you have a comment or a question, or you can enter it into the chat window. Please remute yourself afterwards so that we don't have too much background noise going on. And with that, I will ask Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I guess I have to share my screen.
That'd be a good idea.
There we go. Okay, as Chris said, we have a lot of information, so we'll get going. And I'm going to turn it back to Chris to talk about cryptography.
Okay, and I just pasted in all the links into the chat on the my portion here. So this came about because of as a sort of in response to a post that Tom put into the members forum. And so cryptographic hashes are very, very useful things. And a definition that I got there is that it's an algorithm that takes an arbitrary amount of data input. So you can take any size of file. And you put it through this hash function, and it will give you a fixed size output of characters. That's the hash value. The two important things about this, it's not reversible. So from the hash, you can't produce the original file. And then the other thing is that any modification of the original file at all will produce a different hash. And so why that can be useful is that one use of it is to verify that a file has not been altered in any way at all. So what you can do is you can hash the file. You can let people know what the hash value is, and then they can download the file, including getting it from other sources that may be untrusted sources. They can hash the file, and if they get the same value that you've posted for that file, they know that that file has not been altered in any way. So very useful thing that you can have happen. Now, you can manually hash a file. There are a lot of utilities that are available out there that will do it. Two that I found, there's a Windows one from the Microsoft Store called HashTool version 1.2, and the link is there. It's in the chat as well. And it supports a number of different hash functions. Some of the common ones now, SHA-256, and some of the higher ones, getting up SHA-384 and SHA-512. MD5 is an older one. SHA-1 is an older one. They're typically not used anymore. In Linux, and they also have a Windows version of this, you have GTK hash, and it's currently at 1.4, and it supports a whole bunch of hashes, and you can see the screenshot there of all the different hash functions that it can actually do. And, you know, in this case, there are five of them that are checked off, which means that when you run this hash, it'll actually produce the five different hashes for that. So if you're using HashTool for Windows, the version 1.2 that I noted there, this is a screenshot of it. And the first thing you do is you select the hash type that you want, and you can see the different hash functions that are there. And so in this case, I selected SHA-256. Then you select a file or multiple files, and then it will produce the hash, and it'll also, by default, it gives you the file name as well. You can customize what the output screen actually shows. The reason why they include the file name there is that you can actually hash multiple files, so you could select a dozen files, and then it will show you, in this case, the SHA-256 hash of each of the files, and it allows you to line up which hash goes with which file. So a very easy program to use. The GTK hash, which is available for Linux and Windows, basically you go into the edit preferences and you select what hash functions you want performed. Then you select the file and then you click on the button called hash and then you will get a list of the selected hashes. And then you can do whatever you want with those, copy them, paste them, compare them to, a source or whatever it is that you want to do. Now, there is an easier way. And what you can do is you can actually add it to a tab when you look at the properties of a file. So as most people probably know, if you right-click on a file, one of the options will be properties. And it'll tell you the file size and security aspects of it and things like that. But if you install these additional implements, then you'll get an additional tab on there. And for Windows, Hashtabs, which is the program that Tom pointed out in the members forum, if you install that, you will actually get that tab. And then you can go into configure and you can select which hash functions you actually want, and it'll list off the hash for that particular file in that case. Now, if you happen to have the hash of a file on the clipboard, when you go to that tab, it will actually see if it matches up with one of the hashes, and it'll tell you, yes, this is matched for SHA-256 or whatever hash it's matched for. So it can be really, really handy on that. For Linux, the GTK hash, if you use one of four environments in the Linux world that I list there, so Mate, GNOME, Cinnamon, XFCE, and I take it that the first word is actually the file manager that you're actually using, but I'm not 100% sure on that. Alan can correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks. And then it will actually come up with whatever the selected hash functions. It'll come up with the hashes for that. So really kind of a cool way if you are want to compare files to an original and make sure that it hasn't been modified in any way at all. Most software distributors, certainly in the open source world, are really big on giving out the hash functions for their executables. And so you can compare to make sure that they haven't been modified at all.
And also that you've got a good download when you're downloading, you know, 2 gigabyte ISO file.
True. Yes.
It's useful to do that. Now, the other thing, Chris, is that in both of these things, I believe, you can actually take the hash file that you download from the web and include it in that box that says check. And then the program will automatically check against the hashes it found.
Oh, okay. Good. Cool.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. It is a very useful little utility, that thing. So moving along, we have another share this time from Chris.
Yeah, this one I came across, this is kind of cool. It's each of these chapters in this Power On, the Story of Xbox, is a video that's about 40 minutes long. So a lot of material here. But it really goes back to the first originating ideas of when Microsoft was deciding to come up with a gaming console and how they came up with the idea, the challenges they had, and so forth. It's kind of fun to watch. I ran it at 1.5 speed and I had no trouble, following along with it. So you can cover it off a little bit quicker than the 40 minutes times six. But for anybody who's interested, not only in gaming consoles, but also just in the evolution of a product put out by a company like Microsoft and challenges they had, successes, and so forth. It's really a cool series to watch. So check it out if you have any sort of interest in that at all. And the link to that is in the chat window as well.
So is the red ring of death a close cousin to the blue screen?
In a way, it is. It's a little bit more severe than that, because what it was, it came about because there was the power on button on the Xbox had four colored segments around the edge of it. And if three of those all of a sudden ran around and went to red, basically you had a dead box. You couldn't power back on at all, nothing. And Microsoft had a huge number of their Xbox consoles of one generation or another, I forget which one it was, that ended up with the Red Ring of Death. And they ate, I think it was in the billions that they actually ate, replacing these things at no charge to customers, including shipping and all the rest of it.
Doesn't sound like it was completely dead. It looks like you had a nice red nightlight.
Yeah, that's about all you had.
Okay, well, moving along, my series on looking at moving from Windows to Linux, and we've been looking at all kinds of software packages which I use in Windows. And so far, we've got a clean bill of health here. Everything's got a nice green tick against it. But you'll remember that some of these things have needed a few tweaks here and there to make things work more or less the way that they used to do in Windows. So the next item on the list is my income tax program, which is TaxMan. And if anybody's used TaxMan, it's a program which is produced by Gordon Thompson on the West Coast. I believe he's based in Victoria, BC. He's actually an accountant, and he developed this program for his business. So he's doing tax returns for clients. But he makes the program available at no charge. And the only wrinkle in it is that, for me anyway, for Ontario, that there's no net filing. So you have to actually fill out all the forms and then literally print hard copy and mail it to Revenue Canada. So that's the downside. The upside is that it's completely free. And personally, I hate the idea of having to pay to do my income tax. So I'm all for, I'm all for free and open source. So this one's freeware. So this is my preferred income tax package. So downloading the TaxMan executable for 2020 and trying to install it using Wine in Linux. The Windows installer comes up. And we press on the install button here, and essentially it blows up. And you notice that we get an error, object linking and embedding. And the problem is this file, DAO2535.tlb. So this is some kind of Microsoft, it's almost like a dynamic link library, as I understand it. And it's fairly obscure. I can't find it on my system, but Wine seemed to think that it needed it to install TaxMan, and without it, TaxMan doesn't run. And it turns out TaxMan is actually a Microsoft Access runtime file. So it's the Microsoft Access database, which is being used to drive all these forms and do all the calculations. And Microsoft Access has a pretty poor, I'd say reputation, but performance in Wine. It's very spotty in terms of whether it works or it doesn't. And I haven't been able to find any way to get TaxMan and Microsoft Access runtime to run on the Linux. So for now, at least, I've had to put a big red X against that, and TaxMan ain't going to run on Linux. And now I suppose I could use a web-based tax program. The problem is I don't think there are any free Canadian income tax programs anymore. The one that I used to think of was Studio Tax by a company here in Ottawa, but even they have started charging for their product now. And so at the moment, I'm not quite sure what to do, although I do have one little idea in the back of my mind, and we'll come back to that. So for now, I'm going to mark it as it doesn't work right now, but maybe. So later on, we'll see about maybe. And in the meantime, Tom says, no problem, stop paying taxes. Good idea, Tom. I'll send CRA over to your house. Okay, so our next share is another one from Chris on making things digital.
Yeah, so thanks to Linda on this. She pointed out a service that is available in Canada for doing this. So if anybody has videotapes sitting on their shelf or hard copy film, 35 millimeter film or Super 8 film and things like that, or you have old photos lying around, or 35 millimeter slides that you'd like to transfer into a digital form, there are some options that are available. So the one that Linda had come across, next, there we go, Walmart, they actually have something they call their digital transfer service. And here's some of the formats that they can do and the prices. that they have available. So videotapes, there's a lot of different formats that are available that they can convert, and the cost at $45 to $55 Canadian, depending on the quantity that you want to do. So film reels, they'll do 8mm, 16mm, Super 8, and $31 to $166, and they, rather than number of feet, they cost that out according to the size of the reel, like an 8-inch reel or 3-inch reel or whatever. Hard copy photos, done for 80 cents to $1.30 each, depending on the quantity. They don't actually specify in their pricing structure about size. And 35 mil, slides, you can do 35 millimeter, 35 millimeter super slide, 110 and 126, and 80 cents to $1.30 again, depending on the quantity. Note that they do not have negatives in their listing. So if you have color or black and white negatives, it looks like this service will not handle it for you. So the way it works is you ship it off to Walmart, and apparently you cannot bring it into a Walmart store. You have to actually mail it to them, and they will send you your original stuff back, and they will give you the digital files on flash drives. And the delivery, they claim, is 15 business days, so 3 weeks, basically, from receipt of the material. They have no mention on the website about what the resolution will be of the files that you get, color depth in the files you get, format of the digital files. I presume that they're in very common formats like JPEG or whatever for, you know, scanning of photos and that, but they don't actually mention it at all. And they don't mention anything about limitations on print sizes. So can you send them a 16 by 20 print and get them to scan it? I have no idea. So I think if anybody actually uses this service, I would really like to hear any of the additional information like that, what resolution you got back. You know, if you tried to get 8x10s scanned, was it okay? 11x14s, was it okay? So if anybody could do a follow-up for that, that would be really great. Now, I looked around a little bit more just to see if there were other options, and Costco, I seem to be getting some feedback on the line, but I'll plow on through. Costco has one, but it's only U.S.-based, and it uses a U.S.-based service called Yes Video Incorporated, and it is remarkably similar to what is done with Walmart. So I would be not surprised at all if Walmart is actually shipping it off to the U.S.-based service Yes Video Inc. down the state somewhere, getting it back, and then shipping it back to you from there. Warehouse or whatever, because this Yes Video is not available to customers outside the U.S. If you had a service, something like My U.S. Address in Ogdensburg, you could probably, you know, ship to them and get them to ship it back to there. But if you're trying to get it shipped to a Canadian address, I verified with them that they just said, no, we don't do that. Another option is Staples. Now, Staples is only a service that for hard copy photos. So it starts at $39, which will give you up to 99 photos, and it goes up to $229 for 1,500 photos. They have some additional things that are kind of cool on it. Color correction. Now, who knows what they're going to do to the color of your photos. Red eye removal. Another one that's kind of neat is they'll actually scan the back of photos as well, because a lot of people put notes onto the back of the photos, when it was taken or where it was taken, things like that. They will scan those as well. And they do it at 600 dot per inch scanning, and they deliver it on an 8 gigabyte flash drive, and that is included in the price. And again, there's no mention of a limitation on the size of the originals. You can also, if you want, bring it into a Staples store and get scanning done, but you're limited to 300 dot per inch scanning resolution, and you get it saved on a DVD as opposed to being onto a flash drive. Or you could do it yourself. So the Ottawa Public Library's Digitization Lab at the Beaverbrook branch will allow you to, and this is just verbatim off of their website, scan, preserve, print your photos. You can batch scan slides to digital files. I know they do 35 millimeter. I don't know if they do other sizes. You can convert VHS tapes to DVDs, and you can convert 8mm film to digital files. So there's no other Super 8 and things like that available, apparently. They do have media available there. If you wanted to be able to print things out, or if you want to store them onto a USB, you can buy one from them. or an SD card or things like that. The equipment is bookable for self-directed use, and at least some of it, I believe the scanning of 8mm film, you can actually take the equipment home and use it at home. There was at least one category in all of that that allowed you to bring the equipment home and do it there, because it can take quite a while to actually do some of these transfers. So the link is there for the digitization lab. I don't know what their hours of operation or if they're even open at this point in time, but that's where you'd go if you wanted to book time in the lab. And that's it.
Thanks, Chris. And my recollection is that the size of those USB drives and SD cards made them incredibly expensive. So if you're going to do it, take your own magnetic media.
Yeah.
Well, your own media, flash drives, whatever. Okay, thanks, Chris. There was a few comments in the chat about whether the library would do. What did he say? Tom says the library can convert documents and pictures, not videos and movies. But I don't think that's true. Jan said you can do VHS to DVD.
Yeah.
And the website says you can do 8mm.
Yeah.
The film.
And I've talked to the people who were one of the librarians who was responsible for the digitization lab going back probably 2 years or more ago. I guess, well, it was in person, so it was 2 years ago at least. And yeah, definitely they had the equipment available to do everything that you see on the slide there at that point in time at least.
Yeah, and Tom says that Handbrake can convert video files, for example, from DVD to MP4. You can use software solutions as long as you can get your original into your computer, I guess.
Yeah, that's once you're digital. This is getting it into a digital format. Once you've got a digital, you can do all kinds of things with it, of course.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot. So our next item is a share from Tom. And I believe Tom's going to share his screen and do a hands-on demo of these two products.
Tom, you're muted.
And Tom's still muted.
Oh, I should be unmuted.
Yes.
And it's, let me try that share screen again. And yes, and there. Okay, so. I don't need there. And so let's, let's get to Firefox, my favorite, and move it down to the screen. And I would like a website that you have problems with ads. I don't know, CNN.com, ABC.us, I don't know. Give me a website, anybody. Let's see. Well, I can try CNN.com.
It's probably a pretty good one.
Of course, I already have. This is U-Matrix, and I have most of that turned on and all of this turned off, but I'm not seeing any ads here. That's why I want someone to give me a new website.
Elizabeth suggesting OttawaCitizen.com.
Oh, try something hard. Because I already have all of that stuff turned off. Let's see. So here's OttawaCitizen.com. All the ads are gone. Now, if I turn this off, you can do that by clicking that thing. And the matrix is this one, so I'll turn that off here. And I'll go Control F5. And now there probably are some ads. This advertisement is not loaded yet. Stories continue below. I don't know why it's not showing up. I do have Malwarebytes on as well. Maybe I should choose a different browser that has problems. But are there any other? I'm afraid I've gotten rid of the ads on most of the websites I access.
Kirsten says YouTube, and Eldon says Best Buy.
Again, those are YouTube.com is, again, a change in voice. I'm home, and I don't have any ads here. And if I play it, I don't get any ads because I have another. There's another add-on that I use. This is the add-ons, and that's because you can't. The U-Matrix and U-Block Origin are not good at stopping video stuff in YouTube. So there's Enhancer for YouTube that I use, and if I go to the controls there. This actually gets rid of all the ads while you're playing YouTube. So that's what I use, Enhancer for YouTube. But BestBuy.com, okay. But actually, let's try BestBuy.com because that's maybe I haven't gone to, haven't done. So let's try USA. New Year's savings event, 50%. Again, there's not many ads. It's just all the stuff that they feature and so on. So how about Washington Post? Because that's always been a problematic one for me. So Washington Post, breaking news. And as you can see, by default, U-Matrix turns things off. I've turned off the script for Washington Post, and that allows me to look at the ads. But even though images are allowed here, because I don't allow the scripts, then allow the scripts, and probably there are all these things, and now I get the images. I'm still not getting any particular ads, probably because I haven't allowed all the other things, pusher.com, scroll.com, wapo.pub, WP Digital. But let's turn it off and reload the page. And again, I'm not getting any ads. How about turn U-Block Origin off? And reload the page. Now I'm not even getting the pictures. So there they are. Our best deal for the new year. One thing you can do in uBlock Origin is to. Oh well, apparently I can't do that here. One thing you can do, here's an ad. And if you want that just to actually disappear, what you can do in uBlock Origin is, I don't have uBlock Origin turned on, so that's probably why it's not doing anything. Okay. All recipes. Okay. Let's go to another. .com. Okay. And again, by default, all of these are turned off. That's what the pink means. You know, it does have the CSS and the image, but the other stuff doesn't appear. If I turn it off, and reload. Guess uBlock Origin is probably getting rid of all the ads. Let's try uBlock Origin. And the orange here, but the yellow means with caution. Red here means that it's blocked, which is the default here. And the same thing, we're double click and MPCDN. So let's turn this off and go. Now let's control F5. We'll reload with everything. I'm sorry, I can't find any ads. Does anybody have another site? PCMag.com, okay. I'm sorry, it's just that uMatrix and uBlock Origin are just too good. So PCMag.com, trouble with that, I visit this all the time for reviews, so.
Tom, I just tried recipes.com. I have ads on top.
And again, no ads. Now, if I turn that off and turn my uBlock Origin off and reload, go back up to the top. Oh, well, there is an advertisement here, apparently, and another advertisement, but it's not showing all those things. It may be because of malware bytes. It may be because of Privacy Badger. Let's try it in another browser. Copy that, and let's go to Brave is not good for that. Brave is, does its own blocking. But here's Opera. And let's create a new tab and put in PCMag. As you can see, I have this, so let's turn that off. And uBlock Origin, I'll turn that off as well. And okay, I'll consent to the cookies. This is PCMag, and I'm still not getting ads. In fact, it doesn't even, I'm not even getting ads down here. Ad choices. What does that do? I'm certainly blocking third-party cookies. I want to block third-party cookies. Opt out on. So this is, like I say, I have this locked down, so I can't. It's hard for me to show you.
I think, Tom, if you try going to CNN.com, I find that once you play any of their videos, it'll go to a page that typically they'll have sponsored content on it.
Okay, well, here's CNN.com.
You're not even getting – it's blocking all of the that's interesting. It's blocking all of the main content on their page.
Well, let's see. This is – CNN.com is good. This turns it on for these things. And lock it and reload. Oh, I have this turns off the fonts and this turns off the JavaScript. So that's probably.
They might be doing it through JavaScript.
Yeah, a lot of stuff is done through JavaScript.
Okay, there. So if you click on any one of the videos, typically you will get, once it goes over to playing the video, you'll get sponsored content playing, going along the sidebars typically. Yeah, this is interesting because normally that would bring up a video, and it looks like it's blocking the video on you.
This is the settings for uMatrix, so I can exit that. And and turn those off and reload. I'm sorry, I'm just too successful here.
Well, as Tristan says, you may have to disable all the add-ons to demo stuff with ads.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. It's live.
Yeah, okay. So there, you're finally getting the video part of it. And typically, you will get over in the right-hand side, it'll actually have sponsored content coming up as well. So it looks like the sponsored content is getting blocked. Anyhow, as you say, it looks like they are successful in doing a lot of ad blocking. So I think that alone is good information.
Let's go back to my slide, Tom, and just tell people about the two main products that you use.
Yeah,
okay, let's go through U-Matrix.
We've got more stuff to cover.
Pardon me?
We have more stuff to cover. Just tell us about the two products.
Well, okay, if you do install U-Matrix, this is what it looks like. You can turn on each cell here by clicking the bottom or the top to turn it off or on. If it's pink, it's by default blocked. If it's red, it's definitely ads and it should block it. There are the way it finds the things is that you can, anyway, if you want me to, that's the logger, that's not what I want. Anyway, U-Matrix is good for blocking all kinds of things. You basically, by default, things are turned off that aren't the site that you're actually accessing. In other words, here it's CNN.com. And you can turn off or on each of these things for each thing you want to be able to play. If you want to, for uBlock Origin, it's similar, except that it does it by domain name. It doesn't do it by, you can't do it by picture or script or CSS. But you can cut off all fonts and you can cut off all scripts.
Are these add-ons available for most browsers?
Yes, they are. This is Opera. They're available for Firefox, Chrome. They're available for, any of the Chrome-based browsers like Iron and Microsoft Edge. These are all in the Chrome add-on store. For Firefox, it's in their add-on store. And U-Matrix, a new block origin, and there are some imitations, so you want to get the ones that are offered by Raymond Hill, Gore Hill, not any imitations or the variations that are on. So I definitely recommend it. As you can see, I have problems finding ads.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Tom, and I guess we'll let people check those out for their own browsers. Okay, so moving along, we have a new segment coming up from Bob Walker, who's going to talk about various privacy options. And so, Bob, you want to share your screen? And we'll start off tonight by considering the internet, which is a good follow-up from Tom's stuff. You need to unmute your mic, Bob.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, and you see the first slide there?
Yes.
Okay, so tonight going to be looking at some privacy considerations A few weeks ago, Tom Trottier gave a great presentation on security and how you have to do security in layers. And over the last couple of weeks, we've had a bit of a look at virtual private networks, including their role in internet privacy and security. So this week, I'm going to kick off a little mini-series on internet privacy. And tonight, I'm going to talk about why you need to guard your privacy online. In future weeks, we'll look at browsers and basic browser privacy settings. We'll have a look at the search engines you might want to use for privacy. We'll look at some of the ways you can be tracked. And we'll look at anti-tracking and ad blocker software. And we'll see after that if there's more things we can add to that. I'll be covering just the tip of the iceberg and pointing you towards where you can go for more information. I'm not going to get into a great deal of detail on the settings for privacy for different web browsers. I'll be pointing you towards where you can go to get online guides. Privacy and security. Privacy is your data private? Whereas security looks at, is your data safe? And data equals information. Privacy and security overlap quite a bit. And it's hard to have one without the other. We covered this a little bit a week or two ago on VPNs, but the same thing holds true. If your internet activity is pretty vanilla, then privacy as opposed to security might not be a big concern for you. But you have to look at how you use the internet. Do you use Facebook and other social media a lot? Do you have skeletons from your past hidden in your closet? Are you involved in any political, human rights, or protest activities? Do you have health issues you don't want your employer or insurance companies to know about? Are you applying for a job at a large company or organization? And this is particularly interesting. A friend of mine from high school makes her living doing deep dives on people for companies looking to hire them or for companies looking to fire them. Do you download pirated music, movies, etc.? Do you go to adult websites? There are all sorts of other things that you might want to not have public online. So if you do any of these things, you need to take your online privacy seriously. This cartoon here shows Mr. Average saying, I'm glad Facebook's taking privacy issues seriously. And there's Mark Zuckerberg talking to the advertising guy, nudist, married, 75K annually. Drinker, minivan owner, beanie baby collector. So the people who are looking at your information or digging into your information know a lot about you. The threats, while Google trackers are present on 82% of the web traffic, 25% of the web has a hidden Facebook tracking pixel. Facebook knows a lot more than just what you do on Facebook. A third of the 6,000 top websites have more than 10 trackers per page. Now, a few years ago on 60 Minutes, they showed us by using software that tracks the trackers, and they went to the New York Times homepage, and right off the bat, there were more than 20 trackers tracking what you were doing on the New York Times website and where you were going from there. Many companies, including internet giants like Google and Facebook, make most of their money by using your personal information for targeting advertising or by selling your personal information to advertisers, insurance companies, and others. There's other internet companies from giants like Amazon to maandpa.com to everything in between who also make some of their money selling your personal information. And don't forget that as well as the Chrome browser and Gmail, that the Android operating system on your smartphone, tablet, or Chromebook is a Google product. And don't forget about Google Home, Google Maps, Google Calendar, Google Images, Google Earth, Street View, Translate, Drive, Play, etc., all sorts of these wonderful Google services. And Google owns other properties like YouTube, Motorola Mobility, Nest, DoubleClick, Fitbit, and a lot of other places where they can get information. By default, most Google privacy valves are open to the max. So when you install a Google Chrome, you have to go in yourself and turn on the privacy settings. And trying to make your way around these, not only with Google itself, but all of the various third-party services that interact with things on your phone, for instance, is often easier said than done. If you want to start looking at privacy settings on any of the Android products, you can look at the website I put the URL for here as a starter, and it'll give you some good guides and places to start. So what does Google know about you? If you use Google as your search engine, Gmail as your email client, if you use any Android devices, any Google apps, Google associated properties, and not just Google stuff, they can track you on a lot of non-Google sites as well. Google tracks every search you make, what sites you click through to, what sites you visit, what pages on the sites you go to, and how long you're there, and even in some cases, what part of the page you linger on. They track what you copy and download. They track who you communicate and with, especially with your emails. If you're using Gmail especially, they know what the contents of your emails are and what attachments and links you send. They know what online shopping you do and what you buy, and even just what you look at. Google tracking on your smartphone knows all of your comings and goings, where you've been and for how long. And I didn't realize how bad this was until they sent me, oh, here's all the places you've been in the last month. And it was quite detailed. And there's all sorts of other information to gather on you. And like I mentioned before, even if you don't use Google products and all that, they can still track you in a lot of other ways. Here's an example. Your picture can be posted many places on the web, like your Facebook profile. Your friend on Facebook can post a picture of you at the great drunken party you're at, or the political protest demonstration you attended. Your picture can be in a news article about your charity work, or about your arrest, or about your house fire. Your picture can be in any kinds of websites or on a blog, in an email, or pretty much anywhere on the internet. And it can end up in places like Google Images for anybody else to see and use. Now, I was going to use an example on this. On the first slide there, I mentioned Tom Trottier's excellent series presentations on security. And I looked up on Google Images and put in his name, and there's his picture. And I was going to put his picture there and then use this as an example here, but I didn't have time to get in touch with Tom and get his permission to do that, and I wouldn't invade somebody else's privacy that way. So just use a random picture here off Google Images. So what does Amazon know about you? And I got this information from an Ottawa Citizen story, and the URL for the story is at the bottom of the slide here. Ibrahim Samira, he's a Democratic member of the Virginia House of Delegates, or the Virginia Legislature, and down in the States, Amazon.com will, if you do the right things, tell you what they know about you. And he found that they had more than 1,000 contacts from his smartphone. They knew exactly what parts of the Quran he had listened to on December 17th of last year. They knew every search he had made on Amazon, including one for books on progressive community organizing, and other things on sensitive health-related inquiries that he thought were private. And his big query was, are they selling products or are they spying on everyday people? As well as tracking what you look at and buy on Amazon itself, they collect your data through their Alexa, Echo, Ring, et cetera, smart home products. Their e-commerce marketplace, through their Kindle e-readers and Kindle apps, so they know what you've been reading, where you are in each book, what you've read and everything. The same with the Audible audiobooks. Their video music platforms like Prime and Amazon Music track what you watch and what you listen to. Their home security cameras, like the Ring and Wyze cameras, they can track all that. They have fitness trackers, both their own and other ones they sell. And they have many, many online products that they can track you through. The Amazon-enabled devices make recordings inside your home. And that includes the Alexa and Echo products. And the Ring and Wyze security cameras capture every visitor to your home. And what if you have these cameras inside your home? Are they watching you at home? And as much as they say they don't, every once in a while, it turns out that, a little bit of an error there. And we inadvertently recorded somebody inside their home. The information they get from this can reveal your height, weight, health, your ethnicity, and there's clues to this contained in voice data. They can figure out your political leanings, your reading and buying habits, your whereabouts on any given day, and sometimes who you've met with. Chris has brought this up before. If something on the internet is free, if you're not paying for it, then you are not the customer. You are the product being sold. Even if you are paying for a product or service like through Amazon, then you are still just another product being sold. Google, Facebook, Amazon, and a lot of other companies want you to live your life online and in the cloud so they can know everything about you, no matter how personal. And the more they know, the more they can sell. Data and information on people has been dubbed the new oil, and it's fast becoming one of the most valuable resources on earth. And that's why these companies can make so very much money selling your personal information. So what, if you've been using the internet for years and years, isn't that horse already out of the barn? And yeah, to a certain extent it is. They've already got a considerable dossier on you. There's not much you can do about the information these companies and organizations already have, but you can make it harder for them to get any more. And you can start with the browsers you use and their settings, the search engines you use, using anti-tracking and ad blocker software, and being aware of what the threats are and where to go and where not to go. There are companies that will try to remove specific information about you from the internet, but it's like a five-dimensional game of whack-a-mole. As soon as they manage to erase it from here or there or whatever, it pops up somewhere else. And there are stories of teenage girls whose nude pictures have been posted by ex-boyfriends, and they've hired these companies to try and get rid of these pictures off the internet, and it just keeps popping up and popping up and popping up. Another thing you want to keep an eye on privacy-wise is genetic testing. There's these companies that do testing for ancestry tracing and for health information, like Ancestry DNA and 23andMe. And they share some of their data with pharmaceutical companies and other organizations that are doing genetic research. Now, in their agreements, there are opt-out clauses to the sharing of your data, but these clauses may be hard to find, and you may want to dig a bit deeper into their privacy policies before you use their services. Now, I'm a retired senior IT project manager from the Public Health Agency of Canada, and we have a lot of applications that keep track of different diseases, conditions, and everything else. And within those, there's a lot of data and everything. And I had a team of data analysts whose entire job was to anonymize the data before it got passed on to the researchers. So any personal identifiers had to be removed. And to a certain extent, that's what Ancestry and 23andMe say they do. But there's different levels to the anonymizing to get rid of everything. And one of our researchers showed that just with somebody's postal code, their sex, their age, and a couple other things, they would know who that person was. And it's not with the entire postal code, it's just with the first three digits. So it can be, there's different levels of what the anonymizing can be. There's the passing your information on. An example of third-party data sharing is your banks and credit card companies. They have their privacy policies and all that. I asked this question here rhetorically. Do you know what their privacy policies are? Because I don't know what the privacy policies of my banks and credit card companies are, but we do know that they share data about you with the credit reporting agencies. But who do the credit reporting agencies share that data with? And who do those they share it with share it with? On and on and on. So what are our governments doing about it? The Canadian government is very concerned about the privacy of its citizens, but is doing very little about these concerns. The American government is even worse. It's pretty much open the Wild West here. The European Union has got some much more advanced privacy legislation than Canada or the U.S., but they can still do a much better job at protecting the citizens' privacy. And it's sort of a balance between the people and the companies that keep the economy going. The Chinese, Russian, North Korean, and other governments are actively involved in hacking, spying, ransomware, cyber warfare, selling hacked information like social insurance numbers and more to the baddies and all sorts of other things. And with the internet massively crossing international boundaries, what can effectively be done? Can the Canadian or the U.S. government put restrictions on what data a company in Kazakhstan can gather on you? This is a little bit pie in the sky here, hence the picture, but should these companies and organizations be required to post their privacy policies where they're easy to find and be written in clear, simple, concise, non-Harvard Law School languages the average person can easily understand? If you've ever looked at the privacy policies of some of the sites and companies, it's pages and pages and pages of legalese. Should these companies be required to allow their users and customers to easily opt out of sharing some or all their personal information? Should these companies have their default privacy settings set to the maximum instead of the minimum and allow you to back it off where you feel it's appropriate? Most of the organizations and governments that are dealing with your personal information don't have your best interests at heart. Unfortunately, just like your security, your privacy both on and offline is really up to you to look after. So tonight we've looked at some of the reasons you need to be concerned about your privacy. And so next time we'll start looking at what you can do to protect your privacy. And we're going to start that by looking at the various browsers and the basic browser privacy settings. In the meantime, I came across this great article. It's titled The Best Anti-Tracking Software, but it really is a very basic guide to several of the things that I've mentioned tonight. And it's good to have a look at and get a start. And that's it for tonight. Let's see if I can stop the share here.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Bob. I'm just looking here. Jocelyn says, if anyone wants to exercise their privacy, it's easy. Don't go on Facebook. Don't buy Alexa. Don't get DNA tested. Google, Facebook. And other versions of data gathering is pretty benign. I can't think of an example where I was adversely affected. Comparatively, China's version is far from benign. Okay, so that puts us just about on the time. If anybody has any quick questions, I guess we've got time to think about that. If you have a question, you have to unmute your mic or put something in the chat window.
How about you just continue on and we can revisit if there's any questions right at the end.
Okay, so we will have a Q&A next week, January the 5th, so send us your questions and answers to anything that gets posted next week and topics that you'd like to share. And from Chris and I, we'd like to wish you a happy new year since this will be the last Q&A for 2021. And finally, we're going to leave you with some thoughts. Don't forget, for example, if you're not a member, you can join right now and get 2 years membership for the price of a single year. I just remind current members that your membership will be extended automatically. And I think you'll see something about that in the newsletter or certainly coming up. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of things for you to kick off your New Year's resolutions list.
In the chat, Bob, if you could paste into the chat the defendingdigital.com address into the chat window. We had a question for that. I don't have a copy of your deck, so.
Yeah, the deck will be posted on the website later today, probably.
Yeah. And I don't see any other questions so far. So I think with that, we can wrap it up. So thanks very much, folks, for showing up. It was a pleasure as usual. And hope to see you next week.
Next year.
Next year, yes.